And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Chatter on Books, and I keep losing track, but I believe it is our 46th episode.
You're just making these numbers up now.
Yeah, but no, it sounds good.
I'm just confused because the Apple iTunes one looks different. The number seems to be different. We're coming to you from our favorite undisclosed location with Michael and David and Jean and filling in Eric tonight for Claude, who's at the Anita Baker concert. Belated happy birthday, Claude.
Happy birthday.
So we have some really good random thoughts tonight to start off with, and we have to get a debrief from Michael about the infamous Thanksgiving dinner. I almost shared that photo, but I didn't do that. More of a family debrief. Who was reading what over the holiday? Jean Weingarten, whom I have read for a thousand years. Jean McManus, how long has he done that column in the Washington Post Sunday magazine?
Oh, gosh. I think he came to the Post in the mid-'80s. And probably has been doing that column, wow, I would say 25 years. Yeah.
Might be one of the few things I regularly read in that magazine. Mm-hmm. Two-time Pulitzer Prize winner.
Yes.
We've had Pulitzer Prize winners, but I believe he's a two-time.
And it's funny
Pulitzer
because Prize you winner. Read that column, which is one part of Gene, and then you read his Pulitzer Prize winning stories, and that's just a whole other part of Gene.
Yeah. Did he win a Pulitzer for the story about the young woman who left her child in the car?
Yes.
That was a Pulitzer,
yes.
Right? Yeah. I remember that.
And
was
about
amazing.
The musician who
correct.
Sat on the street corner,
right.
Well-known musician who sat on the street corner and played like a street beggar.
Right.
I started to read that one about the child left in the car. I can't do that.
Oh,
I cannot read those stories.
It's amazing. It's an incredible story.
Yeah.
It really is.
And there are so many things we could talk to him about. When he gets here, including this book, which I know you all have been busy. It's called One Day, The Extraordinary Story of an Ordinary 24 Hours in America. And it's really something.
It's something.
Really something. So many different stories, but it is all tied together. But before we catch up, Michael, on dinner, which so many people are excited to hear about, I did go to Calvert Woodley today, which is a little quieter than it was pre-Thanksgiving,
yes.
Just a wee bit. Saw Michael, who says hi to everybody, and he gave us tonight, David and I are the ones doing this. This is a lovely red, it's a Pinot Noir from Oregon, and it is called Planet Oregon. It's a 2017 Pinot Noir. Steve, who works there, who doesn't get excited about much, said, I don't really like American Pinot Noirs very often, but I really like this one. I think it's really good. It's almost as good as our Exopto, David, I think. Not sure.
This is really
good. It's lovely. Mm-hmm. And Ibrahim was on duty today at La Cheeserie. He gave us a Morbière. Is that how you say it, Jean?
I do not
Morbière.
Know.
It's French.
I do not know.
It's a French cow's milk, semi-soft with this distinctive black line through it.
Oh, yeah.
Michael?
Mm-hmm.
Yes? No? Yeah, it's pretty good, right?
You can really taste that line.
Yeah. Okay, we got some randoms. Michael, I'm going to go to you next, but first, a thank you note from Nevin Martell from last week. Jean, you missed it.
I listened. He was great.
As we like to say, great. This show is not much about books. It's about a lot of other things.
Yeah.
It was about a lot of other things last week. Nevin sent us an email to the gang. Thanks so much for having me on the show. Again, to Turkey Smells and Thanksgiving. It was a blast. Have a happy and bright holiday season to everyone. All my best, Nevin. So now this goes into the archives. Nevin, Ron Charles, Kerry Callahan, Mike Crowley. Written thank you notes mailed in an envelope with a stamp on it.
Listen up, authors.
No kidding.
How far that goes? Just to listen.
I save them. I have a little folder upstairs, and I put them in there. Does anybody know the price of a stamp these days? Eric, you know the price of a stamp these days? It's 50 cents.
Yeah.
I just still have those.
The forever stamp.
Prize fits all.
50 cents is a lot. Okay, Michael.
Can you use those stamps when I'm shipping the shirts?
So do you have a large yet? Do you have a large yet?
I have found two extra larges that I could probably swing your way, but the shirts will be, and just let me know what you want. I'll have them sent to your house.
So, Michael, last we talked about Thanksgiving. You were getting ready. There was a lot of discussion about resting time.
Oh, yeah.
There was a lot of discussion about a smell of a particular turkey. You
want
to give us the highlights?
Dry brine. Yeah. So we're going to start with this. The tip time was 5:45, and we nailed it.
Good.
Nice.
That is a really good test.
Yes.
We had a beautiful cook on the turkey. Big, big thank you to my sister. Let's just say the smell of the turkey, persisted. So when she came into town on Tuesday, I had her drive down.
You know, bad smells never go away, Michael. That's just a good life lesson.
It didn't intensify. I still am not. It might just be that that's
so. Can I just say one piece of advice? When you open a bag and the contents of the bag smell bad, it's not going to get better. It's only going to get worse. Just march that baby right on back to where you bought it.
Well, I went to a reputable just...
Yes, I know you did.
...food purveyor, and I trusted. I trusted them.
He had an igloo chest.
Over a five-day period, I think I went to the supermarket 9 to 10 times.
Yes.
I texted Dory every time I went there. So Tuesday evening, we went to the store, just a local chain, picked up a very frozen 12.5-pound turkey, de-thawed it safely, didn't have enough time for the dry brine, did a wet brine, and it was fantastic.
Good.
And we went very simple with all the sides. And this, I was reminded of this. This was my first Thanksgiving in D.C., not only with the boys, my first Thanksgiving in D.C. married, my first Thanksgiving with my parents in about a decade.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow, because
you've been going to South Carolina.
They go to the beach. Yeah, I go to South Carolina.
Nice. So what were your sides?
We did a very simple fresh beans that we just warmed up in a herb garlic butter from Trader Joe's. Mm-hmm. They have a great prepared section for that stuff, and just tossed it with some of the crunchy onion bits, but didn't want the whole casserole feel.
Right.
Wanted it to have a little bit of bite to it. My sister mashed
Talk among
the potatoes. And we're big into stuffing, so I made two big trays of stuffing that had been cooked earlier in the day for snacking and enjoying as everything else was getting prepped.
And was it like an herb stuffing or?
I'm not going to lie. I do it straight out of the bag, but I added a lot of celery, a lot of onion, and I make sure I add a lot of just sage, savory stuffing just to liven
That's
it up a little
favorite.
Bit. And then right before we served, put it back in the oven uncovered just to get the top a little bit crusty. Just have a little bit of crunch.
All right, now walk us through the whole turkey experience. Just every step of the process.
Of the carve, of the prep.
Prep and the cook.
Luckily, my sister gave me insight into how to defrost it. Mm-hmm. So we had a bucket going. I went out to my local Ace Hardware store. I had a drip going just to try and get the water rotating to avoid any bacteria. I had a simple
the patient is on a drip.
Oh, yes. I needed a different drip after going through two turkeys and seeing the amount of money spent on this one meal. But no, the most fun for me is playing with temperature, because once you get the door closed, I only opened it once. I didn't want to,
right?
But it was to try and even out browning, just because you always have one hot spot in the oven,
right?
And then I want people to crowd around me as I start making my cuts into the bird, because I know that they cannot.
What type of cutlery do we have?
Oh, this was, I don't know the exact brand. This was a German chef's knife.
Okay, so you had no problems, sliced right through.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
And did a certain person with the initials TK behave himself?
He did. So he's very upset because I had made a stock with some extra turkey drumsticks that I picked up in the slow cooker. So I wanted those smells wafting through the house. Mm-hmm. And I figured out if I had that to help make a ready-made gravy, all we had to do was make the roux right at the end, stir that in, and try and get it to the thickness we wanted. So I cut all the turkey. I know that the girls in my house want some leftover turkey sandwiches, so I'm trying to reserve just some of the nicely cut uniform pieces of the breast meat. And I put a to-go bag for Tony of just the discarded drumsticks.
Which have no flavor.
The remains
that have been worked over.
No flavor.
They've been leached of their flavor.
He called me 2 days later. It's like, there wasn't much meat. We have a saying in our house, save the bones for Henry Jones, because Henry don't eat no meat.
But I heard you gave them an assignment. They had to get the wine.
They had to get the wine, so Mom went out to Calvert, brought over a very good Pinot that we were actually looking for in our neighborhood, a Flowers Pinot that was already sold out. She brought a good dry Riesling that's still at the house, just because in all the preparation and the boys, we didn't have that. We don't do hors d'oeuvres and sort of a wine.
It's not a day for hors d'oeuvres.
This is football in a day.
It's not a day for hors d'oeuvres.
Yeah.
David, any Thanksgiving good stories, horror stories?
As always. I told you to. We went to
Carmine's.
That's what we do.
Did they live up to expectations?
Oh, my God. Enormous portions for the seven of us sitting there. It just was ridiculous. You sit there and it's Why does anybody need this much?
No one does.
Nobody does. It's insane.
Yeah.
We literally filled like 8 trays full of leftovers for various people that couldn't make it. It was just, it's so obscene.
How many hours? How long from when you sit down to when you leave?
I think we were there 2 hours.
That's nice.
Yeah it was nice.
And no cleanup.
And no cleanup.
That's huge.
My dad's 91. What he wants to do.
Sure.
It's what we're doing then, you know, so I'm fine with it.
It's nice to have it planned, predictable.
Yeah.
It's nice to know how it's going to work. Gene, biggest difference between a West Coast and the East Coast Thanksgiving?
No difference in menu because my sister is the chef and she's, you know, encoded with East Coast menus. But the difference is that she had 34 people for Thanksgiving dinner. So my younger sister and I went out and billed ourselves as East Coast Kitchen Help. We should have had t-shirts that said East Coast Kitchen Help.
Michael can help you with t-shirts.
And so we landed on Monday evening and spent Tuesday setting up tables and chairs and plates and forks and knives and spoons and wine glasses and water glasses. And then Wednesday hit the ground running in the kitchen. And
34 is a lot of people.
34 is a lot.
Count it.
That's an amazing. Yeah. Why is she so popular? I'm just curious.
She started this dinner, gosh, probably 30, 35 years ago, just her family and another family. Just over time, they've attracted these sort of rogue, this rogue crowd that comes back.
West Coast.
There was a couple who were going to move to Atlanta this year and said, well, we'll be back next year. We're going to come back from Atlanta next year. Yeah.
Nice. That's something.
It's very, very nice. But people were so close to each other at this table, these three tables, that Anne began the meal with his introductory remarks saying, make sure when you're eating that you're not eating from your neighbor's plate, that you're eating from your plate, because they were all mushed together.
Nice. I'm still amazed at how long, we always have 15, 16 people, everybody has to do something. Everybody takes an assignment, whether it's a salad or a side dish or whatever, so you spread out the work, which is great. But I'm amazed. So, Michael, you and I both went to the store 18 different times in the week leading up to, never less than $150, as far as I could tell. Mm-hmm. So much work goes into it. And David, we couldn't keep people sitting down for 2 hours if we held guns to their heads. It was maybe 15 minutes sitting down.
Eating and running.
Eating and then eating more.
Yeah.
And then taking off for a little while and then coming back for pie. So it's kind of like watching the Super Bowl. There's so little actual playing time. Thanksgiving, there was so little actual playing
time. Well, and my poor mother, when the Redskins played on Thanksgiving Day, would spend the whole day in the kitchen. It would be a 4 o'clock game.
Oh, sure.
And then at halftime, we'd scurry into the table, eat our food.
12 minutes.
Scurry away back for the second half.
It was a great scene from The Blind Side.
Yeah.
Great scene from The Blind Side, where they all have takeout and then they're watching the football. Okay, David, tell us we're not going to get excited about the Redskins. We're not going to get excited about the Redskins.
Why would you get excited about
that? Okay, just because some people are. Some people are.
No. So, Gene, they got guys off the street. Literally, guys off the street.
Go 1-0 today.
And played well. They went 1-0 yesterday. So
here we go.
Okay. There you go.
So, Gene, we made fun of some lists last week in your absence.
I heard that you did.
We came up with a better list.
And I would say I'm not a fan of lists.
Yes,
I'm just curious about them. And so one of the ones that has really struck me and kind of ticked me off for quite a while was published in 1998. And it was the best English language novel published in the 20th century by a jury of scholars and writers, this was determined. It was the editorial board of Modern Library, now a division of Random House. The board members, not surprisingly, were all men, except for A.S. Byatt. And their number one book was Ulysses.
Stunning.
Isn't that surprising?
Yeah.
Their number two book was
Moby Dick.
The Great Gatsby.
The
number three book was another James Joyce, A Portrait of the Artist.
Wow.
Lolita by Nabokov was 4. Brave New World was number 5. By the time we get to 15, we get our first woman, To the Lighthouse. By the time we get to 19, we get our first person of color, Invisible Man. And then we go quite a while before we get to another woman, Edith Wharton.
Wow.
At 58.
Oh, sure.
And I just thought...
And this was 1998. It's not as though this is 1853.
Exactly. But I will say this. Modern Library is run by Random House, who was then very eager to start publishing some of their top 10 books as paperbacks. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a self-serving list. But I thought, even in 1998, can you really...
Can you at least pretend?
Can you at least pretend? Could you put Virginia Woolf up a little bit higher or maybe throw Edith Wharton in there? And then I thought, well, maybe they thought that... maybe they thought that Evelyn Waugh was a woman. And they moved her up a little higher.
That was
higher.
A mistake.
Yeah.
That was a mistake. Great Gatsby, though, as we say, Great Gatsby keeps showing up, and you really can't figure out why. It's not because there's a movie out. Gene Weingarten has joined us, by the way. Thanks for coming here, Gene.
Yeah. Hello.
Thanks for coming to the undisclosed location. You can jump in anytime you want. Yes. There are no rules here.
No format.
Great Gatsby keeps popping up for unknown reasons. Absolutely unknown reasons. And then I do look at the list just because of you, and I always take great delight that The Testaments is gone.
Yeah.
Testaments is gone. It's no one's reading it. Right? Don't do the sequel when you got something going, which is great. Okay, before we do what your family was reading, I have to has anybody around this table read or used Strunk and White's Elements of Style?
Yes.
Oh, sure.
Everybody? Everybody? Okay. Sure. Well, nobody lives by it anymore.
I know, I read that.
You Washington Post people can tell me. I don't know what you think of Jay Matthews. But
he's been covering education for 40 years.
He is 137 years old.
Yeah.
Was he not the first editor of the magazine?
Was he? I don't
was
even know
that.
Was
he one of the first editors of the magazine? Do I have that completely wrong?
Jay
I could
Matthews?
Have that completely wrong.
I don't know.
Anyway,
he's, not that I care that much about education, obviously, but when he writes something, I stop and read it because it's so interesting. It's always different. It's always very well written. So he had a piece yesterday or today. I can never tell when these things show up online, but it's talking about Strunk and White and how no one uses it anymore. And that he has, you know, every few years he tries to get people to use it. Michael, you're the closest to the teaching world we know. Strunk and White ever?
Yeah, but I still remember in college courses that was a required text to have.
Well, it isn't anymore. Nobody's buying it anymore. He talks about how nobody's buying it anymore. Mm. Then he talks about a friend who's at San Francisco State who's trying to get people to use it again. And Jay regularly reaches out to schools in the area, and he reaches out to 25, 30 high schools in the area and says, do you use this? Gets no answers. It's absolutely no answers. But the great, and if you don't know what Strunk and White Elements of Style is, you should go get one. In different places I've worked, I've bought literally hundreds of copies of the book and given it to people who worked for me saying, if you can't write a simple sentence, we can't continue
this.
It's
a very small book.
Tiny book. Paperback.
Like the OED.
Fits in your jacket if you want to carry it along. So he's talking about his pal who's trying to get people to use it and they never will. And he says, this is Jay writing, he's 62. Glowing reviews of Strunk and White often come from people that age or older. The author Stephen King, 72, said, quote, every aspiring writer, end quote, should read it. The poet Dorothy Parker, who died at age 73 in 1967, said the second greatest favor for aspiring young writers would be a gift of the book, Strunk and White's Elements of Style. The greatest, she said, would be to, quote, shoot them now while they're happy, end quote. It's true. We've yet to meet a really happy writer.
We're all tortured.
Well, no, I am not a really happy writer. I am a miserable writer.
You meet athletes, you meet people in science, you meet people in technology who say, oh, I love what I do and I can't believe they pay me to do this. You never hear a writer say that. It's hard. It's really, really hard, right? Did you use Strunk and White?
Do you know that Strunk and White barely knew each other?
Right.
It's a very interesting story. Strunk was White's teacher in college, and he created this little book that he gave to his students. And when E.B. White was an older man, he decided this book was the best thing he'd ever written, and he updated it. Strunk was long dead, and he gave him a byline.
Wow. It's remarkable. Yeah. It's absolutely remarkable. Everyone should have it. So that'll be your Christmas gifts, everybody, this year. Okay.
Stocking stuffer.
Who was reading what over the holidays? I'll give you the two books of my relatives visiting.
Okay.
Mother-in-law was reading The Dutch House. Have you done that one?
Yeah. And Patrick.
The Dutch House, about some tragic siblings and living out their lives. It sounded mm-hmm. dreadful, but she loved it. And the Midway book, The Battle of Midway, is making a comeback.
The movie?
Yeah, and that's because of the movie, clearly.
Again, any Midway movie that doesn't have Chuck Heston in it, I'm not even listening to. I'm not paying any attention whatsoever.
Gene, anybody reading? Were you too busy setting up chairs napkins?
During the course of my visit in San Francisco, I started Black Leopard, Red Wolf
good for you.
About four times, but I kept getting interrupted, and then I had to go back to the first chapter because it's very beautifully written, but you need to kind of sit down and concentrate on it. But my sister Anne and I had each read recently Nothing to See Here by Kevin Wilson.
Uh-huh, right.
It's a book that just got a rave review in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago. It is about a woman who's sort of down on her luck and decides to try to take care of two children who spontaneously combust.
Oh,
so I've heard great things about this.
If you think your children have had a temper tantrum, this is nothing compared to these children.
Well, sometimes we wish that my children would spontaneously combust, and we wouldn't put them out, by the way.
And then the other book that I'm just starting to read, and she had already read, was Girl, Woman, Other, which Ron Charles recommended to us by Bernardine Evaristo.
The one that won, which prize did it win? It won at the same time as The Testaments. And Ron Charles said, don't read The Testaments. I'm putting words in his mouth.
It shared the Pulitzer or National Book? I can't remember.
Maybe National Book, mm-hmm.
Sorry.
It was about The Testaments. We didn't remember. Michael, anybody have time to read or too busy buying new turkeys?
I took a break from buying the turkeys. This is a quick, small recommendation as long as you're talking about books on usage and language. Uh-huh. Kingsley Amis had one that was called The King's English, A Guide to Modern Usage. Mm-hmm. Just carried a lot of his wit that we recognize from the novels mm-hmm. into that different format, not necessarily to use day to day, but just an interesting look at the changes. No, so my sister-in-law and I started to reread Philip Pullman's, if you want to call it, Northern Lights, Golden Compass, but with the reinvention of his Dark Materials in the HBO series, wanted to go back to the source material.
Oh, yeah.
And now I want to do a deep dive into the retelling of Paradise Lost within this world of his Dark Materials.
Why don't you just take out knitting needles and stab yourself in the eye? Because that would be less painful.
I did.
Deep dive into Paradise.
Well, I just wanted. Wait.
You took out knitting needles and stabbed yourself in the eye? You just said that.
on a lighter note, Tori, I found myself at a certain chain bookstore with 20 minutes to kill as my wife was getting a new iPad. And so I got lost in the shelves and picked up The Bookshop of Yesterdays, which is about a young woman who's a teacher. She ends up finding an inheritance from her past she's not expecting. And it's a book of clues connecting her with her past, her family, giving her direction as to what she wants to be as she goes through these middle, early professional years. I don't want to give away too much. I just found it very ironic that I found this book in a big chain bookstore that uses an algorithm to tell me what I should read next.
It found you.
Yeah, it really did. But it was a fun, diverting book for the weekend and actually connected with me more than I thought based on some of my own pieces of my background.
Nice. David?
Well, the wife, who's way smarter than I am, is reading two books right now. The Stone Sky by N.K. Jemisin, and she is reading Bad Feminist by Roxane Gay. I don't know if you're
interesting. Now, I've read about it.
A collection of essays by a daughter of Haitian immigrants who grew up in Nebraska and is overweight and queer. Really interesting. A very interesting take. She considers herself a feminist. She just thinks she's really bad at it.
Yeah.
So, and I am reading. Now, did I talk about this a couple of weeks ago? I'm reading a book called How to Kill a City by Peter Moskowitz. I think it's Peter. P.E. Moskowitz is his nom de plume. And it's a collection of reports from four American cities. He went to New Orleans, he went to New York, he went to Detroit, and I believe San Francisco. San Francisco is the fourth city. And it is all about how gentrification is basically destroying every major American city in the country. It's taking all of the diversity, not just racial diversity, but diversity of income, diversity of religion, diversity of everything. And it's making America a giant Walmart, basically, giant Bed Bath and Beyond on every corner. And
Baby Gap.
Yeah, it's fascinating
City Target.
How every city that goes through this has the same repeatable pattern, which is people believe that there's some these really kind of courageous yuppies that go into a city when it's dangerous and it's awful, and they move in, and then more people move in, and that's how a city changes. And it really isn't that at all. It is very, very rich people deciding that, or at least I shouldn't say deciding, understanding when a city is ready to flip. Mm-hmm. Essentially, it is when people can't pay the rent anymore, wherever they are. They find out large swaths of that city where people are having trouble paying the rent, and they go in and buy everything, and then they jack up the prices so that those people have to leave, yeah. And then they can bring in people who can afford to actually pay the rent in that city. And it's fascinating. So it's not so much – it is certainly race-based, but it's really – it's much more about – as with everything, money. Mm-hmm. And the opportunity to buy property cheap and flip it as soon as possible and get really rich off of it. And there's, again, it's a repeatable pattern over years and years and years in city after city after city.
And every city pretends to learn the same lessons.
And so
How did you hear about this book?
I actually went, remember we were talking about bookstores? I went to the bookstore Sankofa Books.
Yes.
Over by Howard University. Yeah. I went and got a coffee there, and I started
looking around. Won't return my emails. Not that I hold a grudge, but they won't return my emails.
I want to pick this one up.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. So.
Okay, speaking of places, I've not been to Baltimore in a long time. Mm-hmm. We were there this weekend for reasons worth explaining, and I think they're doing it better. I'm probably wrong about this, but there are parts of Baltimore now. Baltimore used to be, you go to Baltimore, go, okay, cute street, next to the Inner Harbor. Kids did the Ducks boat ride, you know, saw the dolphins, out we go. Mm-hmm. And then you'd go two blocks away and go, scary, really bad, these kinds of things. They seem to be doing an okay job of developing the inner city area. Maybe I'm wrong, but I didn't see a lot of change.
No,
okay,
that
see,
waterfront is struggling.
Yeah. I think I'd say West Baltimore, not so much.
Yeah. Okay. Down by the aquarium is struggling because it turned into what? I mean, like chain restaurants. Mm-hmm. And
which then closed down. We used to take the kids to the ESPN zone there all the time.
Yeah, there's
because they would get bored with the one downtown.
Pockets of development.
But this was beyond that. This was beyond Fells Point.
Yeah.
This was definitely beyond that.
Yeah.
And it looked real, and it wasn't every chain name that you'd ever seen. So
and some of it, again, some crossed. Of it is they're doing okay, but they're struggling in other places where there's just very little hope.
And that's the doorbell ringing. And Gene, did you invite somebody?
I did not.
Okay. There's nobody else expected.
But I will say that David Simon will be very screwed if Baltimore really has a comeback.
Right. That's right.
The guy is a good, good friend of mine, and it won't be good.
We have a rescue.
He likes that gritty Baltimore.
We have a rescue dog who came from the mean streets of Baltimore, as we call it. And Brian was watching, the bartender was watching The Wire that night. I swear to God, the dog is sitting there watching over his shoulder like, yeah, those are my people. Yeah. That's we need to take them back for
what
us.
What season?
Yeah.
Right. To see which season of The Wire it's for.
Any. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
season
absolutely.
Five is just, it's mind-blowing. It's all about the Baltimore.
Have we talked Succession? I'm halfway through season two of Succession.
I can't believe you didn't just sit down and go straight through.
Because the bartender and I have this is the only thing in our marriage we've ever really held to, which was we swore to each other we wouldn't cheat and go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to wait when we're both home and we both have time to watch it. It's the most amazing show on television. It's the greatest.
Gene, what did you read over Thanksgiving?
I spent the last 6 years writing a book on a 2-year deadline. I didn't read anything over Thanksgiving. I didn't read magazine stories. I didn't read the newspaper. I don't read street signs when I'm driving. This will get better soon, but I'm not out of it yet.
I understand.
Right now you hate words?
Yeah, I
you
really
absolutely hate words.
Hey, I do need to say something to you, Michael. I was your father's editor for his humor column for many years. And we hated each other. We hated each other. I disrespected every line he wrote.
Well, he wasn't that funny.
And he hated every editing suggestion I ever made. Gene will confirm this.
I will confirm it.
Our sessions together were so fraught that editors would come in afterwards and ask if everything was okay. And I just want to tell you, it worked out great. His column was just fine. Mm-hmm. There is a certain thing that happens out of that kind of conflict, and it worked. So, and Gina, hello, Michael.
And Gina, I would say reading the after material of your book, it sounds like you very much have that relationship with your editor, Tom Schroeder.
I do. It's the same
you
relationship.
Hate each other.
Yeah, we hate each other.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And you want to blow each other up, and then, but still, like moss to a flame, you come back to each other.
I call him Tom the Butcher.
Yes.
Tom the Butcher showed up at Politics and Prose when you were there, though, right?
Yeah, he did.
And you got to shout, did he throw something at you, something like that?
No, he was there, though, and I knew he was there and was prepared to do something awful if he wanted to.
So you had to go out first.
Yeah.
So just remember that Gene is sort of the nexus of this love-hate relationship between writer and editor.
So we try to name the, we mentioned the, I don't mention the book often enough, so I will try to name the book several times through our conversation with you, Gene. But it's called One Day, the Extraordinary Story of an Ordinary 24 Hours in America. But let's go back to the beginning. You went to Bronx Science.
Before I even deal with that,
yeah.
Can you specifically recommend that everybody buy 3 to 5 copies?
Absolutely.
Of
yeah. It's the holiday right. gift of
great
a century.
Great stocking stuffer. Yeah. Although it won't fit in a stocking, okay. but
every single person who receives a gift during the holiday season, yeah. I would say in the DMV and beyond, if they don't buy a good. Copy of One Day, what an easy title to remember.
Then yeah. we can proceed.
Yeah, okay.
Here we go.
Yes, I did go to the Bronx High School of Science. It was one of the worst things that ever happened to me.
That's smart kids.
Yeah.
Hard to get in. You got to do math and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I wound up with great grades and great SATs, and I couldn't get into any colleges because they tended to have quotas from individual schools.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. I was dumb compared to a lot of the people at Bronx Science. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not so dumb, though, you tried pre-med?
Well, okay, I was pre-med, but...
Did you make up your resume?
No, the resume...
Wikipedia's wrong.
No, I was pre-med, and then I decided in one of the best decisions I ever made in my life that if I became a doctor, I would kill myself within several years because I also knew that I had a real attraction to drugs.
You'd be dipping into the patient's stash?
It would have been really bad, and so instead I became a journalist.
Accessibility plus time.
And still had the attraction to drugs.
Yeah, but you failed that first organic chemistry midterm.
I have the attraction, but not the access, so it's fine.
Right.
Yeah.
But you did edit the school newspaper, NYU edited the paper, right?
I did.
Yeah. Anything really controversial, anything stick out in your editorship of that? Because that's pretty interesting time.
There was
70s.
One horrible moment that I didn't reveal for many, many years, but there was one night, we were a daily paper with a staff of about 10 people.
That's so amazing.
Yeah. None of us went to classes. Yeah. I mean, that was, you couldn't go to classes.
No.
Right? Yeah, there was no time for that. But there was one night that I recall when we didn't have... We had a hole on page one, and it was 8 o'clock at night, and we needed to fill it. And
here we go. I love it when we make news.
A big picture?
No, yes, it was a big picture, Gene, but I called in a bomb scare to the girls' dormitory. So we did have a picture. Of the girls out in the street. And I'm so sorry, and I apologize to the entire world.
You were never detected.
I was 17 years old. No, I was never detected.
So you were resourceful, in other words.
I was very resourceful.
You got something on the front page.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was the first example of fake news in American history.
Probably not. I would like to think that was the first thing. Okay, dog lover. Did Me and Dog, that was your first book?
No, but it was the only book that made any money.
Yeah.
Because it was, about dogs.
It's probably still available.
Yeah.
Also another good holiday gift, Me and Dog by Gene Weingarten. Okay. What the heck is a horologist?
I fix antique clocks.
First time ever. We've had former astronauts, lawyers, never somebody who fixes antique clocks.
No, I didn't say I did it well. I do it reasonably well.
I remember once I had a clock that had been my in-laws, and I
brought it to Gene and said, can you fix this?
You did
and
not.
He sneered with contempt. It was electric.
Oh, my God. I do. I
just
remember
spit
that.
On it.
Yeah. Yeah. I basically told you to leave.
Go away.
What did you do with it?
Oh, it's sat on a shelf for another 20 years.
I've got and a cuckoo clock down in the basement.
Right, twice a day. So
haul that
problem?
Puppy out. Yeah. Do you have non-electric clocks in your home?
Oh, I have many. Yes.
Oh, is this like a weird Agatha Christie movie where you'd walk into your house and everything's ticking and donging? And
it is, but it's really nerdy, and I'm bothered that you're making me confront this.
We do that in the show. Okay, we'll make you confront your book. I've read it, but tell us the story about how you came up with the idea of the book one day, which everyone should buy. You and a friend trade book ideas all the time. Most
his
of the time, you shoot
editor.
Most of you, the time you shoot them down and say that's a horrible idea.
When you say everyone should buy it, you mean everyone should buy 3 to 5 copies.
All four people listening to this podcast should buy 3 to 4 copies. Okay. Yeah.
Basically, the book was a very bad idea. In the sense that I found myself approaching my mid-60s and deciding that I was getting complacent and that I wanted to do something that I might well fail at. And just for all your listeners who might be writers or would be writers, this is a really bad idea. You don't want to pursue this kind of
jumping
idea.
Off cliffs is a bad idea.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a difficult idea.
And so basically I decided I wanted to prove something that I had been teaching to writers for years but never actually tested, which is the idea that there's no such thing as an ordinary day, that if you take this basic measure of human existence from midnight to midnight, that you'll find an astonishing array of human stories regardless of what day it is. So my editor, my horrible editor, Tom the Butcher, and I went to a restaurant on New Year's Day of 2013.
Where was the restaurant?
It was in D.C.
Old Ebbitt.
Old Ebbitt Grill, Great place.
It is a great place.
And we found some children who pulled numbers out of a hat and came up with a date, and that was the date I was stuck with.
A couple of kids and a waitress.
Yeah, and a waitress. Yeah, the waitress got the year.
And why was that day, December 28th, 1986, why was it a disaster when you first saw
what
day it was?
Well, it was instantly a disaster because the first thing that we did was check what day of the week it was, and it was a Sunday.
David,
which everybody
Gene?
In
death.
This room, death. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you're Sunday
week.
Editor, bad. You're like, you want to shoot yourself.
Yes. You're calling in bomb scares to the...
not in sports, but in every other section.
It's the reason why back in the 80s, the newspaper would plop onto your front doorstep like a bag of wet succotash most of the days, but on Mondays after the Sunday, it would like settle like a leaf, and so that was.
If you
the
worked
first
in
thing.
The government for years and years and years, Monday morning was a blissful morning,
right?
Used to be
understood. And the second thing was that it was the sleepy week between Christmas and New Year's when nothing
even
happens.
Even worse. Right?
Yeah. And 1986 didn't ring any bells either for
no millennium, so, no. Yeah.
So Tom and I just
was born,
sat there.
It's another day.
Is that when you were born?
You were born in 86.
You.
You're a child.
Adorable.
My God.
Eric, too. Look,
Eric, 1986? Excellent. Okay, it's past your bedtime, both of you.
So, yeah, and you know, the question at that point was, do we go for a mulligan? And if either of us ever thought about it, we haven't admitted it to the other. No, we had a date, and we had to do that date. And it just turned out to prove the point, to my astonishment, that there's no such thing as an ordinary day.
So the story, it's on December 28th, 1986, they cover heart transplants. They cover cancer. They cover murders. They cover all sorts of things.
Arson. Yeah.
Yeah.
AIDS.
Jerry Garcia. AIDS. How did you find the stories?
Yeah. Because how is this process? I'm so curious.
Did you just Google December 28th, 1986 and see what
was
came
around
out?
In 1986.
No, but well, working on the book
it was when I wrote the book.
When you wrote the book.
A shocking percentage of the stories in that book began with a Google search.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Maybe 60 or 70% of the stories were based on something that I discovered in the first week by checking the date. The depth of the stories resulted from reporting. I found things that seemed interesting, and then when you dig deeper, you discover they're fascinating and gothic, and mm-hmm. proceed into the past and into the future in ways you never would have thought of.
Were some of the people, so I became obsessed with Steve and Sharon, most improbable couple.
Yes.
Were some of the people, when you contacted them for the book, were they surprised? And they said, you know, how did you find it? Were they surprised when you started talking to them and interviewing for the book?
They were all surprised.
Yeah.
You know, because it was a date that didn't mean anything to anyone.
It was mm-hmm. like an 8-inch story in some newspaper somewhere.
If that.
Mm-hmm. Some on December 29th. Yeah, if that. That's
some
right.
Some of them were a paragraph, you know, mm-hmm. a fire. Three people died,
mm-hmm.
and then you have to start figuring out who were those people,
mm-hmm.
and why did they die, and what happened afterwards. Mm-hmm. Steve and Sharon, two of my favorite people on earth, were a couple. This book has mammoth, important stories, and it also has these tiny things that, when you dig deep, become really interesting. Steve and Sharon were a couple who met on the day for 5 minutes. They were in a dive bar.
A Great
a
Neck.
Pickup place in mm-hmm. Great yeah. Neck, Long Island. They each came with someone else. They saw each other. They got instantly hot for each other. They furtively exchanged phone numbers. The next day, he didn't call her. He said he was going to call her, and he didn't call her, so she called him.
Go, Sharon.
Yeah. Yeah.
So great.
Sharon was not yeah. bashful.
Right.
And she called him, and he said, oh, yeah, okay, why don't we go out? So they went out to dinner, and he came back to her house, fell asleep with his head in her lap. Nothing else happened that night. The next day, he took her to a party, and they got spectacularly drunk.
Because that's what you do the second day you've met yeah. someone, is take them yeah. to an office party and get hammered.
Yeah.
That's what you do.
And at some point during their spectacular drunk, she said to him, don't we love each other? And he said, yeah, I guess we do. She said, well, why don't we get married?
I love everybody after my third bottle of wine. I'm just saying.
Yeah. And she said, why don't we get married? And he said, okay, sounded like a good idea.
As they always do.
As they always do.
After 85 bottles of wine.
And then she said, why don't we tell everyone? And so he did his best to stand up and announce to the room that they were engaged. And the next day, he showed up at her house and moved in.
So great.
It's great, and it's great in many ways, including the fact that that was the first time he knew that she had two children.
Who were living with her.
Who were living with her. They were teenage children who hated him instantly.
Ah, as you do.
And the reason this turned into a great story is that they're still together.
Yeah,
33 amazing. Years later, they're still amazing. Together.
Finishing each other's sentences.
Finishing each other's sentences, going through hell together, coming out of it on the other end. It's a love story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a love story with the most ridiculously improbable beginning you can imagine.
Okay, tell us what maybe you didn't include. Because I always try, as these guys know, I always read the acknowledgments.
Yeah.
And I was struck by You said, I thank Chris Mantufel. Is that, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Mm-hmm.
I thank Chris Mantufel for the chapter I did not write. What did you not write?
Oh, that's really smart of you.
That it's was not smart. Smart to read the acknowledgments, but okay.
No, yeah, no, yeah. It's smart to focus on that.
Yeah.
I had one.
Can you get Gene another beer, Brian?
Because no, we'll get the story. I'm actually fine here, but thank you. Chris Mantufel is my girlfriend's brother, and he's an expert in aviation technology, among other things. He's an expert in everything, and I hate him. But
you're in good company. We hate smart people.
Yeah. And there was a chapter that was my favorite, or one of my favorites, involving the fact that a guy in Connecticut had allegedly flown a heavier-than-air plane before the Wright brothers did. And on the day that I wrote about, a couple of engineers in Connecticut had recreated the plane that he had from his blueprints and supposedly had flown it, proving that he had a design 2 years before the Wright brothers that got off the ground. There were two problems with this story. The first is that it didn't happen on my day. It happened the day after my day.
Mm-hmm. Close only counts in horseshoes and grays.
I know. But you know,
were tempted?
I was still tempted because...
Call the fire alarm in. You can do that.
I'm going to know.
Well, the thing is, they had fixed the problem on my day and tested it the next day. And I could have...
Yeah, I could can see have, that.
Yeah, you just move it back a little bit.
Absolutely.
It was okay.
It was the germ of an idea. Yeah.
Could have been a leap year.
But the real problem with the story and the thing that Chris persuaded me of was that when I looked at the plane, the prototype that was built in 1986, it looked like a bird. It practically had feathers. And even if this guy had done it, and I think he did do it, it was not going to be the prototype of the modern airplane. You know, what the Wright brothers did was the prototype of them. It looked like an airplane. Right, it had wings. Right, right. This thing looked like a Goonie bird. Yeah. And so I reluctantly...
Which kind of makes more sense.
Yeah.
If one is thinking, however many years ago, one is going to recreate flight, then one would go, let me recreate what flies.
Right.
So, yes, yeah. I would. It would look like a bird if I built it.
So, yeah. Reluctantly, with those two problems,
I just killed
the chapter.
Mm. What's your favorite chapter?
I think my favorite chapter is the first one about the heart transplant.
Oh, that could have been a book, Gene.
Mm. Yeah.
That could have been a book.
Yeah. Essentially what happened that day was that in the very early morning hours, a team of doctors and nurses got together in Washington, just outside of Washington, D.C., and performed the first heart transplant in this area. And that's not really what made it astonishing. What made it astonishing is that none of them had ever done it before. They learned how to do it over, and this is a team of 14 people, mostly nurses, a few doctors, who had been working in this macabre sessions in morgues with dead bodies for 2 years, because in 1986 they didn't teach heart transplantation in any medical colleges. It was a very rare thing. You just had to learn it by doing it.
Mm-hmm.
They gave the heart of a murderer to a 20-year-old murderer to a 20-year-old nursing student who was going to die within weeks without it.
And the mother of two.
and right? a mother of two.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the ultimately astonishing thing is that she's still alive.
That's amazing.
Wow. One of the most successful heart transplants, I mean, I don't know how you quantify or how you decide what's a successful transplant, but she's lived for a long time, beyond the averages, correct?
I don't want to get into details because it's a little creepy.
Sure.
But she is among the most successful heart transplant recipients on the planet.
Yeah.
And she's still going strong.
Yeah. Every single chapter, I think, could be a book. Every single one.
Well, there's this wonderful side tangent that Jean goes into about Christian Barnard in that chapter, which is something I never knew about Christian Barnard, which he was a ladies' man.
Yeah, he was very much a ladies' man. He wouldn't do well
today.
Today. He would be brought up on charges today.
That's a pretty good line in a bar, though. Yeah. I do open heart transplants. Come on.
That's sort of what he was, actually.
Yeah. How many people could say that back then?
And he was important in this transplant. He helped the doctors this.
Yeah.
They helped train them. But the nurses who worked with him noted he was hands-on.
So to speak.
Yeah.
Okay, are you more optimistic? Are you more positive about human nature after doing this book?
Yeah, I would say I am.
Yeah.
And I'm, as Jean can tell you, I'm a natural born cynic, but
I can.
This helped.
Okay, I'm going to make you read something.
Oh no.
Yeah, and then after
is
you
it
read
something
it, you
I have
to explain.
Have written?
Yes, and then you have to explain the significance of this is something that appeared in the Miami Herald on December 28th, 1986.
Wait, how do you know about this?
Because it's in your
book.
It's in your book.
No, wait.
Yeah.
I love this when we have authors on, and I start pointing out something in the book, and they go, where are you getting that? This happens more often than you would think. It happens a lot.
No, this might be a big deal.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Uh-oh. Are you going to cry?
No, I'm not going to cry.
Should we have Michael? I'm going to have Michael read it. No, I'm going to have Michael read it.
Because it was very mysterious.
Okay, Jean.
Jean, I want you to have Michael read.
All right, right from there.
I'm a little nervous about this.
Yeah.
We'll see what the butcher left
voice.
In.
You got the nicest voice. So this, according to this wonderful book, one day appeared in December 28th, 1986, the Miami Herald. So, Michael?
The nighttime sky shimmered with mystery and grandeur. A man could get lost in it out there in the blackness in his backyard, sitting cross-legged on the hood of his car, captivated and humbled, oblivious to the bitter cold. A raw tomato, eaten like a Macintosh, was the finest meal a man could want. How could I not have noticed its pebbly, sour-sweet perfection before? A stranger's cigarette butt, hurled from a car window at night, became a thing of beauty, exploding on the road in a tiny, magnificent fire shower. A man can taste water if he tries. A man can taste a woman without touching her if he tries. It lasted several weeks, the sense of wonderment. Then it began to weaken. I tried desperately to hold on to it, but there was no use. It slipped away and, God help me, never returned.
Why are you asking me about this?
Because it's very mysterious.
It's very mysterious. And my sense is this appeared, written by you, in the Miami.
Well, how do you know it was written by me? It doesn't say it in the book.
It doesn't say it in the book, but I've read
but
a lot.
But it's your book.
Yeah, and I go to the Google machine and I...
Oh, write. So you found it.
Yeah,
okay.
I did.
Yeah, it was written by me.
And why did you write that beautiful piece?
Because I had almost died.
By?
In a car accident.
It's a podcast. You have to explain.
Okay. It was in Lansing, Michigan, in the middle of the winter, and I'd lost control of my car because the you know the signs that say bridge freezes
ice.
Before bridge freezes before roadway and I'd never thought about that, and then I suddenly thought about it because my car was a hockey puck and I could not proceed. Yeah, I was just stuck on the bridge, and I got out of my car. Actually, before I got out of my car, I realized that there was a giant truck.
Oh dear.
Coming toward me, and it was a salt truck from the city. It was this 9-ton truck spreading salt, and at the last minute I realized it was a hockey puck too. And it was
a bigger
about
one
to plow into my car, and so I got out of my car to run, but it was ice on the ground, so I was like Fred Flintstone, with the legs.
The feet are going.
The feet are going, but you're not moving anywhere. Yep. And it hit my car and threw it in the air, and my car hit me and then bounced over me. It didn't bounce on me. And my jaw was broken, but that was it. I should have died. And so this revelation came afterwards when I realized I didn't have any right to be alive, and I suddenly appreciated life more than I ever could have thought I would have. And then I couldn't hold on to it, because we live through denial. We live by believing that we're not going to die. And everybody around this table currently on some level believes they're not going to die. And that's what that was about.
I think what you wrote, which is so beautiful, I think it lives on in this book.
Yeah.
One day, which everyone should buy 3 or 4 copies. I really do. I think it lives. That was 1986. That's what? How many years? 14. That's a lot of years.
Many years.
Right?
I could have done that math for you again.
Thank you, teacher Kornheiser. It took many years, but I think this book is a result of that.
It's very much a result of that.
Yeah. It's wonderful. What was the reaction to that piece when you wrote it in 1986?
I have no recollection. It probably just disappeared like everything we
wrote. No, I tried to find it. but there weren't as many. You didn't have, because that was print. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have as many, people didn't, you get absolutely the comments. Sure. Now, any story, you can get, you can read 150 comments.
I could actually not find that on the web. I had to go back into the archives of the Post.
I am a Google czarina. Yeah. Anytime you need something, just let me know.
You didn't get it, did you? Oh, you did get it.
I found the article, yes. Absolutely. Great. Yeah.
Good for you.
It was wonderful. It's just absolutely wonderful. Okay, the book is One Day, and really, you just plumbed the depths of ordinary and came up with extraordinary. So, the extraordinary story, usually the subtitles, is that what they're called? Subtitles, mm-hmm. subheads, whatever. Mm-hmm. Usually they don't make any sense, but this one really does. It really, extraordinary stories of seemingly ordinary people. So, Gene, thank you very, very much for coming with us and talking about this, which is going to be the best holiday seller ever.
Absolutely.
Ever.
Two to five copies per
three.
All right.
Good. Three.
Speaking
good.
Up.
All right.
Okay. Segue to my father's birthday tomorrow. Thank you all for indulging me on this. So yes. My dad, Gene, will be turning 98 tomorrow.
That's great.
He has been his entire life a voracious reader. And a few years ago, because he'd read absolutely everything, and I can send him any books under the sun and he'll read it and call me the next day and go, well, what about this? And I go, haven't read it yet. A couple years ago, he started on the Encyclopedia Britannicas, just because they were around, right? And he started A and went to Z, and the joke always was, well, if he gets to Z, that's the end for him. But he's still going. So he's still on the Encyclopedia Britannica. So this segment, which is called Deserted Island, is the only thing I can come up with a birthday present for him, by the way. So thank you very much. Is everybody has to pick a letter from the Encyclopedia Britannica and say, Charlie Clark, you need to jump out of order here. Pick this letter and read this letter in the Encyclopedia Britannica and why. So who would like to go first? Gene would like to go first.
So
you can play if you want, Gene Weingarten.
What is the most commonly used letter in the English language?
No idea.
It's E.
It's E.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh. So your father should start with E, because let's keep him going.
Commonly used, like that.
That the second.
My sisters are still using them, but that's a whole other story.
Do you know, Gene?
T.
A. The second is A.
It's not.
Then T. No, I know you're talking about that acronym, E-T, but apparently A is.
Very underrated letter.
The second, and T is the third.
Okay.
Never would have picked T.
The and A.
Well, that's what I thought, the. That's why I thought T.
Okay. Michael?
Are you rephrasing
my question?
No, I'm not. I'm not rephrasing your question, Tori. When you are a student and in a history class, mm-hmm. You're taking your run of the mill
American history class, you get to the end of May, end of the school year.
Yes.
And you always run out of
days. You maybe make it to World War II.
You never get past the Second World War.
That's right. It's when history stops.
Everyone knows that. So I was just going to assign letter to a number and then just bring up a numbered random number generator. That way, at least you're just sort of leveling the playing field.
There we go. Okay. Mm-hmm. He's looking for new ways to tackle it, there David.
I'm always an A person. I love A.
Because
Aldridge.
No, not just because of that. Because of aardvark. What a great word.
Double A.
Aardvark. How can
double
you,
A.
And it has, I believe, the longest word, anti-disestablishmentarianism, which I believe means against establishmentarianism. So I think I love this. I love the A's. Always.
Kind of your nature.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
I'm an A person.
Mine is H for human. Because he always said he was a doctor. And he said he went into medicine to study life, death, and human nature. And he will love this book. It's already been wrapped and shipped to him overnight. The amount of money I spend overnighting things because I just don't get around to it. But it's on its way to him, along with the Edison biography by Edmund Morris. I'm always a little queasy about Edmund Morris, but it's supposed to be a good biography.
So, Gene, do you have a suggestion?
I will give one, a favorite letter only if I don't have to explain it.
Okay.
Tori?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Can I not explain it?
You don't
it?
Have to explain it.
F.
Okay. Okay. Now I have to tell a story.
That's outstanding.
All right, this will be the Charlie Clark birthday story. So, as some people around this table know, my older sister Katie, who was a wonderful person, for 7 years lived with Louis Black. He's a fantastic comedian. He's the greatest guy in the world. We loved it when she was living with him. We all fully expected that Louis, who was the brother we didn't have, would spend the rest of our lives with us. And she was an idiot, and she dumped him for a horrible person. Anyways, we all stayed in touch with Louis over the years, and we go to see him do a stand-up comedy in different places. And in the early days of Louis Black, anybody going to see Louis Black would have to drink heavily because he was so bad. It took many, many years for Louis to become good. And so maybe 5-6 years ago, Louis's parents, Sam and Jeanette, who were still alive at the time, Jeanette still is, lived in Silver Spring. And my dad was coming down, and so we all said, let's go to see Louis at the Warner Theater, and we'll all meet up afterwards, because my dad knew Sam and Jeanette, wonderful people. And so we take my dad, who was probably in his late 80s at the time, down to see Louis perform, and he's seen him perform a lot, but not recently. And Louis stands up at the Warner Theater, and pretty much every third word was the F word. Mm-hmm. Pretty much every third word. And Brian and I are sitting there just kind of, like, oh, this is really uncomfortable, because my dad is a very proper guy. And every third word, and I'm like, oh, my God. Oh my God, it's okay. It's okay. And we get to the intermission, and my dad, the pinnacle of I don't know what, turns to us and explains to us where the word came from. It has something, of course, as many things do with British naval history. Things always seem to go back to British naval. Mm-hmm. So just being the polite guy that he was tells us that. Great, fine. Second part of Louis' show, the same thing. Every third word was the F word. Show's over. Thank God. We go backstage to hook up with Louis and his parents. I can't say hook up anymore. To meet with Louis and his parents. And we're talking this and that. And my dad hadn't seen Sam and Jeanette for a while. So he's catching up. And he says to Jeanette, who was 90-something at the time, and he goes, when did Louis' career, you know, what was it that really turned Louis' career around? And she goes, oh, as soon as he started saying F followed by three other letters. I mean, didn't miss a beat. And she goes, that turned his career around. So there you go. So that's a very good letter. Thank you very much. So Gene Weingarten, thanks for being with us. The book is One Day. Everyone should get it. Several copies. What's
very
next?
Good to be here.
What's Thank next?
You. Mostly sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
After 6 years of sheer hell.
Yeah.
And you absolutely. Hate words.
Yep.
Yeah. Sleep. Paper.
Yeah.
Typing.
Some, you know, some drugs and alcohol, you know, and sleep.
There you go.
All right. A little bit of housekeeping to finish up. Eric, thank you so much for
thank
taking care
for
of us this evening.
Up with us tonight.
David, Michael, Jeannie, thank you for being here. Gene, thank you for being here. It's hard to have Jeannie, whatever. Go to Calvert Woodley. Use Nationals 5. If you want to get a really great holiday gift after you buy One Day, actually, you could just go 3 blocks on Connecticut Avenue, pick up Gene's book, and then go down the street to Calvert Woodley and get one of these Nats commemorative bottles of wine. Mm-hmm. The bottles are beautiful. The wine is good. So go to Calvert Woodley, use Nationals 5 at checkout, and you get $5 off. And come back next week when we are going to be at the Cap One Arena. Thank you, Luke. Michael's great connections there. We're going to be at Cap One Arena, and we've got a handful of things going on, including Ben Raby, who covers all things sports and has a wonderful book out, The 100 Things You Should Know and Do If You Are a Caps Fan.
Are we taking the ice?
Probably could.
Riding the Zamboni? Yeah,
probably could. Did you guys see the Hershey Bears thing yesterday, the bear toss? It is the absolute greatest thing that happens. I promise I'll end this. Eric's like, I got to go.
He's got things
Claude
to do.
Told me I'd be out of here by now. So I think they do it at other arenas now, but it started out with the Hershey Bears, which is the Caps team, and they do this thing on the game of Thanksgiving weekend where the first goal scored by a Hershey Bears, everyone throws stuffed bears onto the ice. And then all the stuffed bears are given, you have to Google, just Google it. And then all the stuffed bears are given away to kids who are in hospitals and things like that. And it started out as kind of a funny thing. It's gotten bigger every year. This weekend, 47,000 plus stuffed bears were thrown onto the ice. Wow. We love the Hershey Bears.
Thanks, everybody. Much better than octopus.
Much better. See you next week. Thanks, Eric.